It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. This one is going to be intense. You should know we'll be talking about suicide and loss, grief, helplessness. We'll also be talking about moving forward, a 10-ton weight strapped to your back, but moving forward anyway. And this episode is a bit unusual. It's not so much about having a mental illness as it is about watching someone close to you have it and get destroyed by it. My guest is Stephanie Whittles Wax. She's the host of the podcast Last Day, which is all about things that are destroying us and not appearing to get any better. The first season was about opioids. The second was about suicide. Stephanie is the author of Everything is Horrible and Wonderful, a tragicomic memoir of genius, heroine, love, and loss. It's about the life and death of her brother, Harris Whittles. He was a comedian, comedy writer. He was one of the minds behind the shows Parks and Recreation, Eastbound and Down, Master of None, brilliant comedy mind. Died by heroin overdose in 2015. As you may know, I lost my brother, Rick, to suicide. That was in 2007. He had dealt with addiction for a long time and a variety of mental health issues over the years. He and Stephanie's brother led very different lives, but I knew Stephanie and I shared some common experiences. We both watched our brother suffer with potentially fatal mental illnesses, and we couldn't really do much about it. And it got worse, and they died. And then they're gone, and we're still here, and then what? So this interview I had with Stephanie is more like a conversation. And like good conversations do, it might have drawn more out of us than we were expecting. I started by asking Stephanie who her brother was.
I always say that he was my best friend. That's how I would identify him first. Only sibling. Very, very close sibling. And also moderately famous and the funniest person on the planet and quite successful as a human being. Probably the most successful person I ever knew. That's how I would describe Harris. To a stranger.
You lead with the friendship even before the sister.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was a piece of my being. Huge piece. A way that I really defined myself on this planet. So it was really when he left this planet, I had to really grapple with a whole sort of identity issue that I had never heard talked about with the loss of siblings. And siblings are difficult too because everyone has different sibling dynamics. Like I was watching the Billie Eilish documentary and her sibling like make music together and they're so close. And I kept thinking the whole time like, oh my God, if one of them dies, that is going to be so hard because they're like creative partners and, you know, I'm like, I don't know if everyone watching that documentary had that thought, but I certainly thought that while watching.
I thought that while watching it, too. So I saw them on the Grammy Awards. I'm like, oh, don't get too close.
I know.
Something is going to happen. And just to bring listeners up to speed, I lost my brother I lost him first to addiction for many, many, many years and ultimately lost him to suicide after... I think the lingering effects of the addiction, he went down the road from pot to pills to methamphetamine ultimately. And the mental health, you know, the doctor, I'll never forget, said, oh, well, he just had holes in his mind. He just had holes in his brain from all the things he had done to it. So even if he had gotten, and there's dispute about whether he had ever gotten sober, whether he was ever clean. But they said, you know, by what he's done, by the road that he's gone down so long, you know, it's the damage is done. What struck me about reading your book and just learning what I have about Harris over the years there's this sense of resignation that you had about where he was headed. And even after he died, you said that's what was always going to happen. I wonder if you could explain when you got to that conclusion, how you got to that conclusion. What was that about?
Anyone who has ever loved someone who struggles with addiction knows why I got to that conclusion. You said something that really resonated with me, which is that you lost him first to addiction and then to suicide. I feel like I lost my brother first to addiction and then to overdose. But there was a real line in the sand when he called and said, I'm addicted to OxyContin. That was one moment of time where I feel like there was a real sort of like before and after. And then there was when he kept going into rehab and then kept relapsing and then moved on to heroin. And when he told me he had moved on to heroin, that was a real turning point. And I can mark his addiction with these moments. But I think the bigger thing was that we had always had this kind of like unbridled honesty. And I think when he started lying to me and to my family, and there was this division then when I felt like I did not know who he was, what he was doing, where he was headed, what was going on. I could not get a grasp on it. It's like you never expect that call to come in. And it's the most horrible moment I've ever experienced in my life. But in the same breath, you're prepared for it because you're preparing for it the entire time that they're on this roller coaster. I don't know. It's hard to make sense of it, but it's, I just think if you, losing someone to addiction is a real poignant, powerful, crushing loss.
How long of a time span was it between when he wrote to you that he was addicted to OxyContin
mm-hmm.
and his death? How long of a span are we talking about?
2 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it wasn't in his life at all as far as you knew?
Oh, no. No.
Oh, okay. But
no. Before that, I mean, we smoked weed together. I remember him being in a Little League outfit and doing whippets in my bedroom when we were teenagers. I mean, we went to a performing arts high school. There were drugs, for sure, around. So he was a recreational drug user. He was a fish head.
P-H-I-S-H.
Yes, sorry, yes.
Jam bands.
The jam band, which is just, oh, God. And recreational drugs were part of his brand. I mean, he talked about it as a comic. He wove it into storylines. So all of that was well within limits of normal.
Yeah.
I think that the real turning point is when he said, I cannot control this and I'm spending $4,000 a month on pills.
Yeah.
I mean, that was 3 days before my wedding. So that was fun.
The thing about the honesty really sticks with me, because here's a person you have known literally your whole life. You know, like you probably don't remember any time before him in your life.
No.
He's 2 years younger than you?
Three.
Okay. Like the honesty is just built in. This is just somebody you're always with. I remember with my brother, there was the reality that he was describing at a certain point no longer matched the reality that I knew of. Like the things he was saying, I was unclear if he believed them or if he was just trying to put one over on me, trying to cover something up. But it is like this curtain kind of enters the room and you can't tell what's real anymore. And
correct.
It's incredibly lonely. Like how did the deceit enter into it with you and Harris?
I think lying, I have since come to learn, is a way that the addiction survives. It's a way that the addiction thrives. And not only lying, but sort of pushing people away who don't care about your addiction. Like, Harris getting high was not my priority, but it was certainly his. So the deceit was like just truly not being honest about where he was. I mean, I remember this one vacation we took with my, at the time I had a 6-month-old, and we went to Utah, and we were in this beautiful mountain setting, and he just looked horrible. He had bags under, dark circles, bags under his eyes, really greasy hair, really edgy and set off easily. And he kept saying, you know, he was looking for an AA meeting on his phone, and he kept saying, I don't know why I can't drink a fucking beer. Like, I'm not an alcoholic. Like, I can drink a fucking beer. And he was just like so mad. And I was like, hey, this is a 6-month baby, my dude. Don't you want to hang out? She's so cute and fun. Why are we not having a fun time hanging out with my first spawn, you know? And I just was like, I knew he was using. I knew he was using. And then you feel like a crazy person because I'm like spiraling about how he's using, and then he's denying. And by that point, he had already started using heroin.
Mm. Did you know that?
No. It's like this gut check that you have. Like you said, you've known someone your entire life. I know him so well, and he's not himself, and he's lying to me about what's going on. And he's, you know, so there's like that aspect. And then there's just the aspect of him not being an integral, supportive, nurturing, kind, delighted member of the family, you know? Like, I need you to be experiencing this vacation in the way I am. And you are not. And you are, quote unquote, ruining this vacation. And that is shitty. You know, so there's like a lot of like that happens too, where there's holidays that feel ruined and there's moments that feel dishonored. And it's hard to not take that in and take that personally and have that start to color everything with darkness.
When in 1999, my father died of cancer, and we were all gathered at the house when it was down to the wire. Like, my sister had come from Europe. My brother had come up from San Diego. I had just gone out to the suburbs of Seattle. I was living in Seattle. And the moment that we had to tell Rick, my brother, that our father had passed away, the first words out of his mouth were, "What time does FedEx deliver here?" Because he was waiting for a FedEx delivery that he said was his paycheck from work. Wasn't the paycheck from work. It's that same ruining of moments that you talk about. And there's been others, you know, there's Christmases and everything when he was using, and we knew he was using, and he was downplaying that he was using. And for me, it made me so angry that it threw red over everything else for the next several years. The violation, you know, the betrayal of it all. What was that like for you? Were you able to get past that when he was like that and just say, well, he's sick and he needs help? Because I knew intellectually he's sick and he needs help, but I was so angry about it for so long.
Yeah. I feel like the anger part is not discussed as much as it should be. But I was so angry for a lot of reasons. One is that he was making me keep his secret. He would tell me I couldn't tell my parents.
That he was there using.
Or that he'd relapsed and that I couldn't tell my parents, or that he was putting himself in various situations where he could die and I had to sort of carry that alone. You know, I was trying so hard because I knew rationally, like, I have to be his ally and I have to be his support system. And if I cut him off or scream and yell at him or play into the anger that I'm feeling or give in to the anger that I'm feeling and respond and react from that place, that I'm going to lose him. So I was like playing a part almost of, yeah, tell me anything. I'm here for you. You know, why are you doing this to yourself? Can you go get help? I mean, it's like, and then inside just like screaming. And whenever that happens, when you are pushing down and pushing down and pushing down, especially anger, like I don't identify primarily with anger as an emotion. When I feel unsteady, it's usually like shame or like self-loathing or, you know, those sorts
of
things.
You turn it on yourself.
Yeah. So anger feels like very uncontrollable for, like, I don't like it as a sensation.
Yeah.
It's very scary. And I don't, it's not like my primary go-to. So there would be moments where like the powder keg would like explode and I would be like a blind raging maniac, you know, because I had had 6 months to a year of like pushing it down and pushing it down.
Suppressing
and then,
it. Yep.
Yeah. And then just being like, you're the reason that everyone is horribly miserable, you know? And then it's like, well, that doesn't help anyone. Yeah, so it's so messy. It's just like a very messy experience for families.
More with Stephanie Whittles-Wax in a moment. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. Back again with Stephanie Whittles-Wax. We're talking about her brother Harris and my brother Rick, and about our families and ourselves. If you're waiting to hear us talk about how after all this, now we're fine, we've solved it, we figured out the answer, and we're over it, that's not coming, because that's not how it works. But there is a lot of ground to cover. I want to ask about the charm of your brother, because addicts can be, let me rephrase, people with addiction. I try to use the person first language as much as I can. People with addiction can be very, very charming, because they have to be, because they're trying to pull something off where a substance is more important than any human relationship that they're doing, but the humans are the gateway to the substance that they need. By all accounts, long before he was in a problem with substances, you talk about Harris being just one of the most impossibly charming people you've ever met.
Oozing with charm.
Oozing with charm.
Anyone you met, who, I mean, he was genuinely, that's his primary defining feature.
Yeah.
And anyone who knows him, either people you know and you see in the news and the media, or like, you know, the person on the street, will all say the same thing. That was a charming motherfucker. Like, he was like 5'6" or uh-huh. I don't know, maybe 5'7". I think he was 5'6". And he was like, you know, like this kind of like for a very long time, this just sort of like scrawny little Jewish kid. And like every woman was in love with him. Like I think maybe men too, but I think Aziz told the story about how Harris said that every woman has at least a 20% crush on him. And he would say that with such confidence. But it was sort of true. I mean, just very funny. And the other part of his charm and sort of magic is that he would listen and laugh at everything you said. He was this like very attentive, he was just fun. He was a really fun person to be around, to talk to laugh with, to joke around with. Also like extremely frustrating, but even when he was being frustrating and sort of like dogged in something that he was arguing, you were still just like, God, you're so charming.
Well, and it's not always the case with tremendously funny people, which he was, because I certainly have, and I know I'm sure you have, met very funny people who don't really care who's there. They're just mostly monologuing, and what other people have to say are just breaks in their monologue, basically.
Yep. Yep.
But that's quite a setup to be that funny and that engaged with everybody else.
I think that's why he was special, I think. I think that's what the uniqueness was about him. That there seemed to be a genuine humility about him.
A generosity,
yes. Absolutely.
Did that make it, I mean, there must have been a point in an addiction, which is, I mean, part of the illness, as we said, other people don't matter as much anymore. What matters is getting more of the substance. You must have been able to see the person you knew ebbing away, and you couldn't get to that guy anymore.
I think that's the worst part, is that you see them drowning, you see them going into the quicksand, or like you're trying to get them to hold on and you are losing. And as a, like you said, there's two different dimensions that you're existing in, and you're in reality and they're not in the reality that you're in. They're in a different reality. And so there's so much frustration and just being like, nothing you're doing is making sense. Just take my hand and come over here to this side, and then you will live. And the inability to do that rationally deeply suggests that something, that there is a disease component of this thing, right? It's like that it's not, it doesn't care how you think or feel. It has nothing to do with your morality or your goodness as a human being. It's like, you have cancer, you are sick. But when you're in that moment and like they seem to be making choices that are hurting themselves, there is like such an inability for the person who's on the other side of that to grasp like why they can't just stop. You know, it's
why can't you just stop having cancer?
Yeah, it's like, right. And when you say it like that, it's like, oh my God. And it's like, you can't possibly have that perspective when you're in that moment. Since he has died, I have spent my life trying to understand where he was better than I did then. And I've said to my parents, I mean, God, like I wish I knew then what I know now. And I feel like we could have, and then you go to that really fucked up place where you're like, we could have fill in the blank, which is like really unproductive. And my dad, who was, he's retired now, but he was like internal medicine doctor forever and knows a little bit about a lot of things, said, that's like the the frustration and the problem with medicine, right? It's always evolving, and you're, what you know now, you couldn't possibly have known then. We just know more now in that field. We know more about addiction. We know more about what it does. You're dealing with a different set of information. It's so not useful to apply current knowledge to 6 to 8 years ago. It doesn't mean I don't do it all the time, where I'm like, oh God, I really blew that, you know, and having to grapple with, you know, feeling like I didn't do enough. That's a huge part of it, I think.
Yes, absolutely. I would find myself getting, as I think back on it, it's almost not even angry. It's resentful to the person who took this person away, even though it's the same person. Rick had come up to my parents' house for Christmas, and he was talking to my either girlfriend or wife. I can't remember how long ago this was. And I said, well, how are you doing? He's like, well, I just have this problem with spiders. And I said, really? What do you mean? He says, well, I was just in the shower. I just took a shower, and they just have spiders all over their shower curtain. I said, what do you mean? Like, you saw a spider? No, like hundreds of them crawling up and down the shower curtain, because he was high as fuck. And I remember it as being, comedy is a big currency in our household. I remember it being like, that is funny if someone is speaking plainly about spiders on the shower curtain.
Totally. I mean, yes, absolutely.
But I also, it was a crossroads of like, oh, I have to talk to you. I wasn't really talking to you this whole time, was I? I was talking to somebody else. And then it became this edge of like, you're the asshole who took my brother away. You know, mm-hmm. you're the guy who would have come out of the shower and had a perfectly phrased joke about it. And our brothers were very different. I mean, yours was a comedy writer. Mine drove a truck and, you know, kind of slipped you the subtle jokes when he trusted you, but he had trusted me and that was all gone. And so that became the guiding principle of like, I think I created two different people. Like there was the person I was talking to, and then there was my brother who that person was holding hostage.
Very much so. And comedy, same in our house. We didn't know how to relate to each other, still don't in any other way. And so there's that part of it, that resentment. And then there's also a resentment that I felt for what he was doing to my parents. You know, I was like, you are ruining them. They are destroyed. You know, I mean,
you're killing them right in front of me.
Like literally they're dying on the vine right here. And it's hard not to resent that, you know. It's hard. Reason has a really hard time existing in this space, I find.
But it strikes me, as having read your book, you stayed engaged with Harris the whole time. I mean, right up until a few days before he died. Were you still trying to save him at that point, or did you think, I can't do that? That's not how this works.
I never thought I can't do that. I never had that thought.
You were always trying to save him.
I was always like, even if I wasn't trying to save him, I was always like, he's gonna get better. He's getting better. This is the one that will work. This is the rehab that will work. This is the moment it will stick. And again, knowing what I know now, I know that that's just like completely not how any of this works. But he had been at the sober living house that he was living at. I guess he'd been 7 weeks in total staying there.
Consecutively?
Consecutively.
It's a pretty good run.
Yeah, he was in a detox for 4 weeks, and then they moved him over to the sober living. And I even had this moment when he told me that he had been in the detox facility, or that he was going there, that I was like, wait, why would you be going to the detox facility? You're sober. What, like, even after he had relapsed multiple times, I could not understand, right? But you're sober. You didn't tell me that you relapsed, so then you didn't, right? It was like, I don't know. There's a naivety that is part of it. And he had just gotten the role of a lifetime. He had just gotten the best career news that he had been waiting on and that he was so excited about. And, you know,
tell us what that role was, because I think that's important.
So he was writing with Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang. They were working on Master of None. And Harris was a big part of season one on that show and the writing of that show. And so much so that when he, this is the charm. Okay, here's an example of the charm. The rehab let him leave to go right on the show during the daytime. Like, he arranged with them that he would be able to go do the writing of the show and then come back at night to the rehab.
He was so charming that he talked professional rehab people into letting him run around LA during the daytime.
Exactly. Yes.
That's pretty charming.
And I mean, it's like crazy, you know? And then I realized later that Aziz, who was picking him up at his house every morning to take him, like they would ride together, he had no idea Harris was in rehab at that point. He hadn't told them. I mean, he was telling different things to different people. And anyway, there was a character who was Aziz's character on the show, his best friend, who ended up being played by Eric Wareheim, who did a great job with the role. And the character's name was Harris. And Harris had to audition to play himself. And that was really funny. That was just, you know, there were so many layers of funny that we were enjoying there. And then he got the call, like, I want to say 5 days before he died, maybe less, that he got the role of himself on the show. And all he wanted to do was act. I mean, he loved writing and he loved telling the jokes, and he played the recurring role of Harris on Parks and Recreation. And he was always so charismatic and funny on screen. And that's really what he wanted to do. He wanted to move into that and do some more acting. And this was his moment to do that. He was so excited. He called us and had the Airbnb tab open on his computer. When he died, he had just booked a place in New York. They were going to leave in 2 weeks to start shooting the season.
More with Stephanie Whittles-Wax in just a moment.
Hey, I'm Janet Varney, host of the JV Club podcast. Ah, high school. Was it a time of adventure, romance, and discovery?
Class of 95, we did it!
Or a time of angst, disappointment, and confusion?
We're all tied together by 4 years of trauma at this place, but enjoy adulthood, I guess.
The truth is, it was both. So join me on the JV Club podcast, where I invite some great friends like Kristen Bell, Angela Kinsey, Oscar Nunez, Neil Patrick Harris, and Keegan-Michael Key to talk about high school, the good, the bad, and everything in between.
My teenage mood swings are getting harder to manage.
The JV Club. Find it on Maximum Fun.
Are you feeling elevated levels of anxiety? Do you quake uncontrollably, even thinking about watching cable news? Do you have disturbing nightmares, only to realize it's 2 in the afternoon and you're up? If you've experienced one or more of these symptoms, you may have FNO, news overload. Fortunately, there's treatment. Hi, I'm Dave Holmes, host of Troubled Waters. Troubled Waters helps fight FNO. That's because Troubled Waters stimulates your joy zone. On Troubled Waters, two comedians will battle one another for pop culture supremacy. So join me, Dave Holmes, for 2 doses of Troubled Waters a month. The cure for your news overload. Available on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm talking with Stephanie Whittles-Wax. Before the break, she talked about how her brother Harris Whittles seemed to be on an upswing at the time he died. He was getting ready to film the series Master of None, in which he was co-starring.
So I fully thought we were done.
Yeah, that he had gotten better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It shows you, though, this idea that, well, if I just tell him all the things that he has to stick around for, all the reasons why he should treat himself better. I mean, you write about your daughter Iris, who's, you know, was at that golden age of baby toddlerdom where they're just a riot.
Yeah.
He's off to pursue his dream. And and in a rational mind, that would be great. And everything would be going great. And because we're in a rational mind when we're looking at it, it's so hard to understand why they would just use or go down that road anyway.
And we're like conditioned, I think, as humans from a very early age to believe in happy endings.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, that's like, obviously, this is the happy ending. He's been through a lot, but he got his big break. And this is, he's going to do it now.
Yep.
You know, it's like, I mean, he did, the night he died, he did a set at a comedy club in LA called Meltdown. And
I bet he killed.
He killed. And I kept asking in my, and it was the series finale of Parks and Recreation that week also. And he had written on the series. I mean, he'd worked on it the whole, save for the first season. He started in the second season. And he'd worked himself up to being a co-executive producer on the show. I mean, he worked his way up from a writer, staff, like writer's room writer to the, you know, the heavy title. And so he had done the comedy show and then came home and wrote my mom an email and said, "You're going to love the finale. I'm so proud of it. I'm so grateful. I love you." You know, it's like he just finished this incredible accomplishment, the show that everyone loves. You know, show me someone that doesn't love Parks and Rec, and I will show you an alien. And then he was going on to do the next thing. And yeah, logically, you think that amounts to a happy ending. So when it doesn't, it just bucks all common sense.
I think that we are a story-driven culture, and I end up talking about this a lot, and apologies to listeners who've heard it before, but we talk about, what did you see on Mad Men? Well, have you caught up on WandaVision? Have you caught up on this? And we're used to a three-act structure. We're used to a struggle and then a climactic, how are they ever going to get out of this situation struggle?
Yep.
And then they're older and wiser and they're fine. And it's a hard thing for people to accept about any kind of mental illness, whether it's addiction or whether it's, you know, schizophrenia or depression or anxiety or anything. It's just a mess. And it just stays a mess.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. It does not follow the three-act structure.
No, it really doesn't.
It really does not.
Harris didn't die by suicide, but did he die by suicide? Do you think he knew where he was going and just was accepting that?
I really don't.
Really?
I really don't.
You thought he had it under control or was managing it?
Yes. This is the big thing, right? Like, we would talk about the 12 steps and he could never get beyond one. He always thought he had like scammed the system. He thought.
What is number one, by the way?
Accept that you're powerless.
Oh, yeah.
He would never accept that he was powerless. And he would give me all of this, like, God bullshit. He'd be like, I don't have a higher power, blah, blah, blah. I don't believe in God. It's like, dude, it's not even about God. Like, believe in a tree. I don't know. It doesn't, whatever. But no, I truly, this is the problem. I don't think he ever thought he would die. He was like, yeah, everyone else could die from this. I won't die. Like, he had a massive fucking ego. Like, on top of everything else, he was like, truly thought he was 10 feet tall.
Well, he'd gone to Hollywood and crushed it right out of the gate. And
yeah.
It was just like this comedy savant.
Truly. I mean, and I tell the story in the book, too. Like, I remember when he was like 13 or 14, he did this comedy he had a sketch comedy group, and he rented out a theater and walked across the stage completely naked with a cowboy hat over his penis. Uh-huh. It's like, what? Like, no shame. Just did not have that part of your brain that feels embarrassed or
hesitant.
Hesitant.
Yeah.
You know? So, no, I really do not think that he thought he was going to die.
In regard to that, the powerless thing, could you share? There was a drug or a medicine that was offered him in rehab where he would not be able to go. Can you explain that whole situation?
So there's like a bunch of MAT or medication-assisted treatment options out there that I also did not know about at the time, that if anyone listening to this has any sort of opioid use disorder, please ask your doctor about medically-assisted treatment or medication-assisted treatment. And there's a bunch of different kinds. There's Suboxone. There is the one he was refusing was called Vivitrol. And it's basically a shot you take and it blocks your ability to feel high for like 30 days. And they offered him Vivitrol 3 times and he refused it every single time. This is something we found out after when we went to pack up his house in LA. We went to the rehab and we sat down with the director, which was really a true mindfuck in many ways. And he said, like, it's like he didn't want to not be able to get high if he wanted to get high. It's like, yeah, I'm going to do this rehab and like I'm going to do this sober living, but I am going to leave and go write on this comedy show that I like. And I am going to just keep that door open for if I want to get high again. I don't want to block it in case I do want to get high again. Like, I just think he was still trying to control all of it. And him not taking the Vivitrol is like just such a clear example of him not being done.
Yeah, just but a big ego that thought he could control it and use at the same time.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think, well, something horrible can happen and then you'll get back to normal eventually. And it's just forever broken. And it doesn't mean you can't experience joy, and it doesn't mean you can't have fulfilling experiences and relationships. But I wonder if you could talk about your experiences with that, of like just because I measure my life as to who I was before Rick died and who I am after. Mm-hmm. And that's the major dividing line in my life. Like, you know, that's the birth of Jesus timeline of my life.
Yes. Yes.
And I wonder what your experience is with that idea.
Yeah, it's like people talk about acceptance as a phase of grief. And I don't think you ever accept that they're gone. It's impossible to accept. I don't want it to be this way. I will never want it to be this way. But you accept, like, these are the shitty circumstances now. You know, it's just like I think I compared it in the book to like pants, when you're like, your pants don't fit anymore. And you're like, at some point you just accept, like, well,
yeah,
it's time to get new pants, right? Like, I've had 2 kids. Size.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in a new decade. Like, just accept that you need a new pair of fucking pants and that you can't fit in the other ones anymore. You know, like, it's like this resignation. And, you know, there's, I don't focus on it as much anymore. I don't think about that empty space. I fill it probably like to a neurotic degree in a way that like does need constant therapy. Because I had Dr. Gabor Mate on my show, who was this trauma expert. And I was like going to talk to him about his thesis that all people who have addiction are traumatized in some way. And I was like, well, that's obviously not true, because my brother had a really great life and was not traumatized at all. And then he ended up flipping it on me and being like, let's actually talk about your trauma. And now you are a bona fide work addict and you are just filling that hole with all sorts of things. And I definitely, you know, do that. It's like you have this hole and you either fill it with like tears and just unbridled emotion and grief and messy, sloppy pain and suffering, which is where I deeply was for like a year. And then since then, you fill it with the company that you run and all the things you do professionally. And, you know, it's like...
Is that so you don't have to think about what happened?
I think it's just like a natural... I think it's just how I cope with things. It's just like, I think about what happened all the time. I literally made a show about it. I wrote a book about it. I've made a lot of my career about it, you know? So I am thinking about it all the time, but I don't think I'm touching into like the feeling part of it all the time. It's...
You're not getting to the vulnerable place?
I mean, I would have no time to do anything else if I went to the vulnerable place every single day.
You couldn't get out. You'd be trapped there. We make podcasts, and not to emulate happy endings like in movies, but just because people tend to want this at the end of a show, what's a happy memory you have of Harris that you hold on to?
Oh, man. There's so many. Like, I don't even know where to start. He, like, bought my mom. My mom collects frogs.
Mm-hmm.
Not real ones. Like, sculptures.
I didn't figure.
Just wanted to clarify. I mean.
She just traps them and keeps them in the bathtub.
She collects frogs. She's a witch.
And find her in the morning at the bog.
And it's like so weird. It's like, well, why, if you ask her, like, why do you collect frogs? She's like, I don't know. Somebody told me a long time ago, you just need to find something to collect. And that's what I chose. She's like Mississippi Southern Belle. And so she collects frogs. We would always give her frogs for her, you know, birthdays, whatever. It's like great when somebody collects something because then you always know what to get them. And so this one year, Harris like gave her an actual frog, like gave her a box. And there was a living giant frog and she like opened it up and it like jumped out and it was like jumping around the house and the dog's like going insane. And, you know, it was just like this unbridled moment of like joy. And so like that's the shit that you just miss, you know? It's like I miss this person who would take this frog collection to the pet store and just like, you know, and like freak her. Like, I mean, the sheer horror and terror that she felt when she opened this box and this live creature like jumped on her. Like, that is just a really great person. My brother, not my mom. My mom's great too. But I just, that person that just constantly pushes it all over the line. I mean, there were so many of those stories, you know, there's like that. And then there's so many examples of that where, you know, we would argue endlessly about whether something was good or bad.
Uh-huh.
You know, like we went and saw that movie. I don't even remember what it was called. It was a horrible movie. And I mean, I remember going into the parking lot, going into the car, getting and going back to the house. And Harris just like just telling everyone like it was the greatest movie we've ever seen. And like his roommate literally almost like moved out after this argument, you know, because he would just get he would just get so like just take things to this level that was just beyond, or like going to a restaurant and ordering like $100 piece of tiny little appetizer steak because we need to experience it, you know, like he just was this like I just don't know anyone else like him. And it sucks when you lose somebody that truly was like nobody else. And that's just a simple thing to say, but it's like, he was great.
Covers it.
He was so great.
Yeah.
And I really fucking miss him, and I wish he was still here.
I want to first thank my dear friend Stephanie Whittles Wax for participating in this conversation. I'm sure it wasn't easy for her. I know it wasn't easy for me. I'm glad we did it. There's information on her show and her book at our website, MaximumFun.org/depressionmode. The conversation that we had wasn't primarily about Stephanie's or my mental illness. It was about our brother's. But it strikes me how much this grief that we were left with feels like, for lack of a more specific word, insanity. It really does feel like, to choose an even worse term, it feels like going crazy. The world is out of whack. Or a truly scary idea here, that's the world that actually exists. The world has been revealed in its true form. A chaotic war zone where the worst things can happen at any moment and there is no such thing as safety. Now, here was the original plan for this episode. The interview with Steph was going to be shorter, and then we were going to bring on Megan Devine. Megan is a psychotherapist specializing in grief. She's the author of the book, It's Okay That You're Not Okay. And I was going to talk about grief and loss from a mental health context. But there was just too much good stuff that we taped from Steph and from Megan, who lost somebody close to her rather suddenly also. So here's the plan. Here's what we're going to do. Next week, our guest is Megan Devine. And Megan is going to talk about the interview with Stephanie. And she'll also talk about just how to make sense of grief. Is the grief you experience a mental disorder, or is that howling pain actually a healthy and truthful response to what happened? And why some parts of the medical community have this idea that after 6 months, you should be completely fine.
The DSM, the diagnostic manual, the person in the white lab coat removed from basically all human reality and looking at stats, they're going to tell you that you have prolonged grief disorder, right? Because it's been more than 6 weeks, more than 6 months since your brother died, and you are, again with the air quotes, still feeling these things. So if you look at the medical model, everybody's fucked.
All right, so rest up. That's next week. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It might help them. Also, something that matters a lot, hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. Anytime you could do that, that kind of engagement, that helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. Also, something that really helps, believe it or not, is for you to get big discounts. The ads that we run often have a special code that you can use to get discounts on the items that we're advertising. Use those things. That makes a big splash. That really helps us out a lot. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Depression Mode is your show, too. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We take requests. Email us via our electric mail address, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. This program exists to help people and can only exist when people support it. You can become a member of our team. You can become a supporter of our show by going to MaximumFun.org/join. If you're on Facebook, make sure to join our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Great talk going on over there. It's often about the things that are talked about on the show, but sometimes it goes into other areas of mental health as well. A lot of nice people supporting each other. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I have notes and thoughts and discussions on all of our episodes there as they come out, plus some fun and silly stuff too. It's free. I'm on Twitter at John Moe, all one word. Same on Instagram. Hey, credits listeners, there are 1 million ants for every human on Earth. That's true. And you can pick up yours at your local post office. That part's not true. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
My name is Corey Funk from St. Paul, Minnesota, and you are worthwhile.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.